When we look at the context of in which the Buddha arose, and again, before I enter into anything, I want to repeat, these are my perspectives, my understandings, my points of view. There are Buddhists of illustrious name, from the most famous of them to the most unknown of them, and me somewhere in between there, that will have maybe very different points of view or maybe very similar points of view. But I'm giving it to you the way I was taught it and the way I examined it and the points of view I've arrived at. When we look at the context in which the Buddha arose, we were looking at a place in India where intellectual investigation of spiritual, of reality, of physics, of metaphysics was extremely refined. Already for 1,000 years before the Buddha, there had been the writings of the Vedas, of the wise people called the Rishis, and the Upanishads, and investigation into the very nature of reality. And one of the big differences in my point of view between the Chinese points of view on that side of the Himalayas and the Indians on that side of the Himalayas was the Chinese were very practical. They were very empirical. So the Taoists were really about practical. What can I do? How do I do this? The theory is not so important to me. How do I do this? Whereas the Indians were much more in the tradition, what I call the Indo-Aryan, which lead into the Greek and European tradition of analysis, of how, what is this? What's the nature of this? So people were examining these questions. And in within that context, we look at the social milieu. Hinduism, as we know it today, only arose a few 100, 150 years, or coalesced, became what it is before the Buddha. By the time of the Buddha, you can go to a Brahmin and pay him a lot of money and he'll go say a mantra or use some technique to bring you more success or more happiness. Spirituality became transactional. Do you understand what I mean by transactional? There was a deal between it. And so if something is transactional, then it's guided by something. And if it's guided by some kind of benefit, then it's definitely, there's ego involved, there's self involved. So comparing that to the universe where there is no ego involved, the universe just goes on its own, or Tao, there's a short circuit. In addition to that, in the society of India at the time, the caste system was very predominant. So there was a tremendous amount of inequality. And once you're born into it, that's it. You can never change it. An interesting side note is that in my life, I've met very educated, very well-read, and somewhat spiritual people from India who will argue and claim that until you're born as an Indian, you can't reach liberation. That means everybody in the world, all of us included, have to be reborn as a Hindu, as an Indian, to reach enlightenment, which is really interesting because when we look at the other side of the Himalaya, many Chinese I've met, and traditionally from the history, we see books written where the Chinese believe that they're the ones that are closest to reality and higher evolved, because the fact that I have hair on my arms means I'm closer to a monkey than they are. And I've heard this in my life. This is not just something it's not hearsay. And so the word for China, Zhongguo, means the center kingdom, the center of everything, the center of the world. So to understand Tao, some people, some Chinese believe that if you really want to understand Tao and Yin and Yang and Laozi, you have to be born Chinese. In any case, the context and the rising of that was social strata in India at the time of the Buddha. So when the Buddha came, there was a lot of tension going on there. And the Buddha came in to try and find the answer to why is this tension always there? Why are we always ultimately somewhat unhappy, no matter what we get? Remember, he was born into a very wealthy family, a very powerful family. He saw three things. He saw old age, sickness, and death. And the thought arose in him, if everybody is going to meet old age, sickness, and death, then at some point, everybody is going to be unhappy, because that's going to permeate life. Because ends has to happen. Transition must occur. Nothing is permanent. So he went out to search for how to find a way to solve that problem. Are you familiar with the word sequela? S-E-Q-U-E-L-A-E, sequela. It's a technical term, it's a medical term usually, that means the after effects of an incident. So if someone has a stroke, you can't move your arm, that's called a sequela, and the sequela of the incident.
Yeah.
So the Buddha went out to find a solution to the sequela of this issue that everybody is going to experience old age, sickness, or death. And the sequela to that is that no matter how beautiful, no matter how much money, no matter how loved, no matter how powerful we are, no matter how much we get what we want, eventually we're gonna have to let it go, or we're gonna lose it, or we're gonna get old, or we're gonna die. And that ultimately, as I've expressed in a couple of discourses before, I think it's three or four, one of the early discourses, my current point of view on this topic is not something that's commonly introduced in Buddhist instruction, but I believe that the existential problem starts with the actual process of birth. That the minute that baby is pushed out of the womb or taken out of the womb with cesarean, even more traumatic, that entity already experiences a panic. Because until that moment, they're in this very protected, very warm, very nourishing environment, hopefully, and being fed and being nourished and growing. And suddenly it has to transit from there to an environment that's suddenly cold, that's suddenly no longer warm and moist, and suddenly there's no nourishment and suddenly has to breathe, the lungs have to start. So I am positing the idea, which means I am throwing out the idea that I think for a fraction of a second or for more, depending on what the situation is, that entity, that child, goes into an existential fear of, am I gonna get nourished? Am I gonna be able to take this breath? Am I gonna be able to experience the next moment? And in a good situation, very quickly, nurses deal with it. Very quickly, the child is brought to the mother's breast or nourished in some other way, and the child goes on. But there's no way, I think, that there can't be that, even if it's a fraction of a second, of panic and what's happening here. I think that's the seed of existential angst and that suffering that that term the Buddha uses called dukkha or suffering, that's where it begins. And then as the child grows, it gets more and more and more. And that's in this life. Of course, we can refer back to in utero situations, we can refer back to karmic situations, pre-birth karma, post-birth karma. There are many other factors, but just taking the pure physiological factor, I think that's where in the body, the existential angst begins. Now, this is all for you to think about. Go ahead, Sam.
So I was gonna say, so the longer a child is being prepped to be given to the mother, the more anxiety this infant is creating in itself?
It would depend on the situation. If the child comes out robust and the mucus is cleared from the lungs very easily and it's warmth in the nurses and there's a lot of love and care surrounding attentiveness in the obstetrics ward, then I think it's not a real crisis, not a real serious thing. But if the child is struggling somewhat, then I would say the greater the struggle the child has between the moment birth starts and, or maybe the moment the child crowns, right, through the vagina, because that's when the child is into air, then, or contractions, the moment that, whatever it is that we determine as the beginning of the struggle until the moment the child has its first breath and warmth, physical warmth, both of those things, that time in between there, what happens there, determines the degree of existential angst that is fundamental or the foundation angst of the individual. I would say that.
Because I have two children, and my first child was cesarean, and my bladder was cut while they were up doing the cesarean, so that child took longer to get to me. And my second one was natural. And he was immediately given to me. And there's such a difference in them. And Oren, you know them.
They're both smart, capable individuals, but one is very at ease with their surrounding, and the other is always worrying about what's going to happen in their surrounding.
Interesting.
Very interesting. So the rest of you out there that are mothers, you can think about that as well, about your child that was born and what happened, if you have several children, compare and contrast. Okay, I'm still not forgetting the question about fruit. How do we get from birth to fruit? So I try to cover as much territory as we can. So the Buddha realized that this issue of dukkha, and I like to use the Indian term, the Sanskrit or Pali term, because suffering is really a limited term. It really means dissatisfaction, discontentment, lack of fulfillment, unsatisfactoriness, pain, many different things. So dukkha. The Buddha wanted to resolve this issue. And in his practices of going into homelessness, which is not being a bhikkhu, being a shramana, which means like today, someone going into homelessness, practicing, that's the Hindu term, practicing different ascetic practices with all these different teachers that he studied with, and we went over that in the last sutra. He was with the two teachers and then left them, and eventually settling on his own, which is why I gave you that sutra to read about how he went on his own after learning what he could learn with the two teachers, and finally realizing the Four Noble Truths, his realization of suffering, dukkha, this existential angst, the origin of it, the cessation of it, and how the steps to resolve it. Origin being, if you recall back to one of our earliest discourses, adhesion or stickiness or clinging. The cessation of suffering or dukkha is the adhesion resolving, so there's no longer clinging. And the steps are starting with right view and ending with right samadhi, the Eightfold Noble Path. So upon realizing this, he then went deeper into understanding till he recognized that the way to stop the clinging is to understand the nature of reality as he had experienced it and to share that. And that required for an individual to be completely focused in their process, completely attentive to the eight steps, which culminate with right samadhi and right mindfulness, or right jhana, dhyana. In our last sutra, we mentioned the jhanas. Remember briefly, I went over the four states of mind, the four jhanas. So one gets into the different states of jhana, and each one progressively is deeper and deeper and deeper until one graduates from the fourth stage of jhana, the fourth jhana, into nibbana, complete extinguishing of the self. Now, if I am hungry, and I need to feed myself, so I go out and search for something, who's doing the searching?
Your stomach.
Whose stomach? Guiding the stomach?
You're hungry.
Who's guiding the stomach?
The body you find yourself in.
Okay, the body what?
Has reactions, like it's gives you a sensation of hunger.
So okay, there's the sensation. Who is experiencing the sensation of hunger?
Your brain.
Whose brain is it?
Yours, obviously.
Well, let's use it in the first sense.
Okay.
So that would be, you're saying, change the your to my. So who's experiencing the hunger?
Ego.
Okay. Can we use a different word from ego? Although that's a good word. What other word do you think we could use instead of ego?
Self.
We could use self. I'm looking for one other word. What other words do you come up with?
Me.
Who is me? What is that? When I go to somewhere, they ask me for a card. What kind of card is that?
A card.
I have to show who I am.
Identity.
Identity.
My identity, okay.
So one's identity is directing the search for the hunger, right?
Okay.
This is a really good point, a great question to Sam, because if it's hunger that the stomach arises in the stomach and the stomach expresses itself, it's perceived, and the body goes in search of the fruit without any identity, then I don't think that would be prescribed by the Buddha. But the minute there's an identity that's responding to the hunger and saying, I'm hungry, mm-hmm. I need to eat, I want to go have fruit, then that would be prescribed. Because one assumes an identity, and the other is just responding to a perception. Do you understand the difference?
Can you say that?
Yeah, lost, yeah.
Okay. If hunger arises,
right,
and there's a perception, remember we went through all these things in the previous sutras, perceptions, feelings, form, okay? So let's go through as we went through the sutras.
Mm-hmm.
There's the body, touch, okay, that sensation. Not the eyes, not the ears, not the nose, not the taste, but not yet taste, and not the mind yet. There's the body, there's touch, feeling. How would you say that? Maybe it would be the mouth. It'd be the mind in the mouth. There's an object out there, and it's a beautiful mango hanging on a tree. And trust me, Indian Alfonso, next April, if you have the chance to buy Alfonso mangoes, the best mangoes in the world. And I don't think they're allowed to be exported to America, though, because of some issue, but they're amazing, like custard.
Mm.
You see the mango on the tree. So all of a sudden, sight, smell, taste, mind, food, connects to the object. Following our sutra, do you remember that sutra? Recall that when we talked about that? Your sense ability, the object, and there's connection, contact. That was the word in the sutra we used, contact. As soon as contact, there's feeling, there's perception. As soon as perception, there's feeling, hunger. As soon as there's hunger, there's a kind of a consciousness. Fill the body. And as soon as there's the consciousness, there's then the mind. Oh, I need to go get that. Okay. Now, if that process takes place without an identity, which seems almost impossible to us in our state of reality, we cannot really truly conceive of that happening without an identity. But according to the Buddha, it can. If it happens without an identity, then it's not prescribed to a bhikkhu. But if it happens with an identity, which is what's going to happen for 99.99999% of most people, I believe the Buddha would say, no, you can't do that because that's distracting you from the arising of a healthy state of mind and would contribute towards the arising of an unhealthy state of mind. In Buddhist terminology, we have two different, very common terms. One is the arising of healthy states and the formation of healthy states, and that's been in some of our sutras. And the other has been the prevention or the arising of unhealthy states.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've also had the contribution to the arising of healthy states. And then we've had the contribution to the arising of unhealthy states. And then there's the prevention of the arising of unhealthy states and the efforts and contribution to the prevention of the arising of unhealthy states. So the desire to go out and take a piece of fruit with identity would be arising, contributing to the arising of an unhealthy state of a perception of an I, if there's identity involved. You see?
Yeah, but still, if you instead of going out and trying to get a mango from a tree, that it gives you do it with identity, like you said. Going out with a bowl trying to get food from someone else is the same thing.
Right. If you're going out because you're hungry, yes. But that's not why bhikkhus go out. They go out with a bowl because they recognize nourishment is required, and whether they get the food or they don't get the food, they should have no response to that. Therefore, if some bhikkhus come back with nothing in their bowl, then they don't eat and they don't have any unhappiness about it. And if other bhikkhus come back with lots of food in their bowl, then they just eat what's given in there. They don't say, I don't want rice, too many carbs. I don't want too much protein.
I guess.
You know, and in fact, one of the biggest, earliest discussions about vegetarianism in my time was that the Buddha died at the age of 81 after eating a meal as a guest, and where supposedly he ate pork. He was fed pork. And this is one story. I don't know, we don't know how accurate it is, but it's a common one in Buddhist, in the Buddhist stories. And one of his attendants, Ananda, who was his favorite, his main attendant, and the one that carried on and recalled all the oral teachings, remonstrated with the Buddha about, why did you eat pork? You know, da 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 da. And the Buddha responds, I was a guest at someone's house. To refuse to take what was offered to me would allow the arising of an unhealthy state, while the accepting it didn't affect it. And my death is not a catastrophe. My death is just a natural transition of an impermanence. So, for example, in one of the sutras that we will go in the future, the Buddha describes the elements that the body is made up of, the air element, the earth element, the water element. It's their description. And he says, well, you look outside and you see the earth element. And there a man comes along and he's hoeing the earth. And you ask, what are you doing? He says, I'm digging up the earth. I want to dig up the entire earth. And then he asks the person he's talking to, do you think this man would ever be able to dig up the entire earth? Of course not. But you look at the earth, you look at mountains, mountains fall. Floods wash away banks. The earth changes. Just as the earth outside is the earth element, so is the earth element in me, my flesh, my muscles. They change and they will go. So if my flesh decays and falls away and I pass, why am I more upset about that than I am upset about a mountain falling? It's the same earth element. Why can't I apply the value of the earth element changing out in nature to what's happening to my own body? Well, the my is the difference, right? The identity, and therefore the identity is separating me from allowing this to happen. So from the Buddhist point of view, him dying, even if it was because of the meat, which we don't know for a fact, it's fine for him. He's in Nibbana state. He doesn't even connect this body to a my. There is no my. For the Buddha, there's no my. So the encouragement to the bhikkhu to have the alms bowl, it's not a begging bowl. He's not going out begging. That's big, big difference. This is a great question. That bowl is called a dana bowl. Dana means a charity or alms. In society where people, money is power, right? Possessions are status.
Yep.
And that hasn't changed in 2,500 years or longer. For a person to stand there with a bowl with nothing, with just in robes that are made from rags that have been bleached and then dyed, is that considered an honorable position?
Not for that society.
Not for most societies, is it?
Yeah.
So, no. But if someone is standing on a corner and you clearly see that person lives off of what's in that bowl, and you decide to put something in that bowl, do you feel good? Mm-hmm. When you pass a busker on the street who's playing the guitar and you put a quarter in there or a dollar or something, do you feel good?
Yes.
So yeah. That person who is performing or standing for alms gives you the opportunity to do something that helps you feel good about yourself. And in principle, they are demeaning themselves. That means putting themselves lower in order to give others a chance to create merit by contributing charity. That's the intent of that bowl. That's very rarely expressed. Oh, it's a begging bowl. Oh, it's not a begging bowl. The bhikkhu, if he's practicing truly, he doesn't need anything. Because if he suddenly dies tomorrow, that's okay. Yeah. If he dies in 100 years, that's okay. This is a very fine line that needs to be discussed after some foundation is achieved with the process of meditation or vipassana or dhyana. Because our first response to this is, well, this is ridiculous. I mean, we have to live. We have to clothe ourselves. Oh, that may have been great in the Buddha's day, but how does one do that in today's world? Well, the Buddha's day wasn't any different than today's world. You still had to have money. You still had to have status. You still had to have power. In fact, then, if you weren't of the upper class, you could be, you know, you touch somebody the wrong way, someone cuts your throat, nobody cares. The crows eat you, right? So at some places in the world today, that's still the same. So it's that person is gone to the point where saying, I recognize that in order to resolve the matter of dukkha, I need to understand reality and find a way to let go of the I. therefore, anything that encourages me to strengthen the eye is an unhealthy, contributes to unhealthy state arising. Anything that contributes to diminishing the eye creates a healthy state. And therefore, going out to pick fruit does not contribute. Going out and allowing people to give you what they feel like giving contributes, because you're giving other people a chance to help and you're not trying to reinforce anything. And whether you have food or not, it doesn't really matter. In addition, you then have time to sit quietly and do the practice, which brings you closer to understanding the nature of reality, which contributes to more healthy states arising.